This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, They shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. Now, protesters throughout the U.S. and Europe have voiced a strong opposition to just about every move that Donald Trump has made since assuming the Oval Office for his second term as U.S. president. Now, in the U.S., demonstrators push back at the Trump administration's moves to fire thousands of federal workers, close Social Security Administration field offices, effectively shutter entire agencies, deport immigrants, scale back protections for people of color, and cut federal funding for health programs. And throughout the world, and especially Europe, protesters are in the streets taking part in hundreds of demonstrations dubbed the hands-off movement. Hands-off the UK, hands-off Gaza, hands-off Ukraine, and etc. And all this adds to protesters' concerns of looming global recession resulting from Donald Trump's aggressive global tariffs regime. And we'll discuss these anti-Trump rallies in your Spotlight program. And now for this package.
But every point in tariffs is worth more.
President Donald Trump's second term has been marked by bold and controversial moves, from imposing tariffs on nearly all foreign trading partners, which he hails as an economic revolution, to intensifying deportation efforts that have sparked both praise and outrage. Trump's agenda has reshaped the nation's social and economic landscape. While some applaud these measures as necessary steps to protect American jobs and security, critics warn of rising consumer prices, economic uncertainty, and the human cost of aggressive immigration policies. The fallout has been global. On Saturday, protests erupted across the world, reaching a fever pitch. In Washington, D.C., tens of thousands gathered, joined by demonstrators in cities from New York to Los Angeles and even as far as Paris and Berlin.
I think it's important to speak up. I think silence is not an option. I think you have to stay engaged. You have to stay vigilant. I think it's not only for our community at large, but the world at large. I think that enough is enough.
The hands-off rallies, organized by over 150 groups, voiced opposition to government downsizing, trade policies, and what many see as an erosion of civil liberties. The message was clear. Resistance to Trump's policies is mounting, and the world is watching. Many remarks focus on the role played in Trump's administration by wealthy donors, most notably Elon Musk, who has served as an advisor to the president and has been playing a key role in government downsizing.
They would have our people believe that the reasons we can't afford rent, the reason we can't afford health care, the reason we can't afford groceries is because of other people in our own communities. Yes, we know that this system is rigged and the status quo doesn't work for Americans, but it's not rigged against the billionaires. It's rigged for the billionaires and for the corporations.
Adding to the tension, recent polls show approval ratings for President Trump slightly slipping. As the dust settles on a night of unprecedented demonstrations, one question looms large. What lies ahead for Trump's presidency? Will the anger towards his policies subside, or will they ignite further division and unrest? Only time will tell.
And now for our guests. Joining us is Mr. John Stepling, author and commentator out of Inderøy, Norway. And Mr. Daniel Patrick Welch, political commentator, joining us from Boston, Massachusetts. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the broadcast here. Thank you for your patience while you ran that report for our viewers. John, I guess we'll start with you in Inderøy, Norway. Good to have you, bud. Your initial thoughts on why do you think the world is mobilizing the way we're witnessing against the Trump administration?
I think that this is what happens when 40 years ago you pulled the plug on public education, and you have an extraordinarily misinformed and politically ignorant population. Not to say that Trump doesn't warrant protest, but of course so did Joe Biden and so did Obama and so did every president back to Reagan, certainly. And I think that part of this is this is liberal America wringing their hands in outrage at things that they perceive as dangerous. I saw no protest signs about the bombing of civilians in Yemen, for example, not one. Very little protest about Israeli policy and the abetting and support for a genocide in Gaza. I'm not seeing any protests about that. In fact, I saw signs at some protests, hands off NATO. You despair at the kind of hopeless stupidity of much of this. But this is the U.S., which has been in sharp decline for at least a decade, longer than that. The transference of wealth to the top 1% happened under Obama. The living conditions, the quality of life has continued to deteriorate over the last 20 years, and really much longer than that. But certainly, I think you can say since Reagan, we have seen a steady decline in job security, quality of life. We've seen a mental health crisis, a crisis of obesity. People are miserable and unhappy, and they also take offense at Trump's style. And there's been a lot of, and understandably so. He talks like a mafia don, and he is insulting to people, and he's crude and vulgar and obviously uneducated. And he has this team of techno bot guys who are equally offensive, I think, to the general public. J.D. Vance has a really questionable bedside manner, I have to say. And so people are offended, but they're getting desperate. And it almost wouldn't matter who was president. If it was Kamala Harris, people would be just as desperate because the system is failing. And that's the message here. It's really failing. And the infrastructure is crumbling. And there are no answers, and there are no jobs, and there's no hope for anybody right now. That's the overriding reality.
Thank you there. And Daniel, thanks for your patience there. Welcome to our Spotlight program there, pal. Daniel, many people in London are holding up signs, no to MAGA hate, dump Trump, resist the tyrant, save democracy. What do you think about Donald Trump and his policies getting people motivated to this level of mobilization? Or to John's point, do you feel he's just been the scapegoat for a declining a living standard over a generation now in America and abroad?
Well, I can't, the hair raises on the back of my neck at labeling Trump a scapegoat of anything. So was I was bummed that John got to go first. I love John. I admire, he's a great writer. But, I figured he'd steal all my lines. Yeah, this is, I am a veteran of these marches. I've been doing it since I was five, going to to counter an anti-busing march in South Boston in 1970. You know, it is important for people to be on the streets. But John is absolutely right. They're angry. They would be angry if Carmel, whatever, was president, but they wouldn't be in the streets because it wouldn't be organized by the party out of power. This looks to me depressingly and sadly like a color revolution, what the CIA has organized in country after country for the last 80 years, all having signs in the same fonts, although they don't need this because, you know, Bernays has taught them to meld people's minds in such a way that they come up with these self-thought things like the picture of Putin's puppets, Musk, Trump, and Vance, right? I mean, this is stupidity gone off the rails. And what do they want? They, meaning the billionaire class's puppets who set this up, the other faction. The other faction of the oligarchy. This is not, you know, billionaires shouldn't be running our government, but they have been forever. And this is just different billionaires. And so now what they're trying to get is back in power without changing anything serious. Get back the reins of power. That's what this is about. That's why you see hands off Ukraine. I mean, we're talking about World War III. We're talking about arming Diego Rivera, Diego Garcia to the teeth so that the Americans can attack Iran. Like, there's crazy stuff going on that's a continuity of long-held American foreign policy that threatens actually the world, not just people on Social Security in the United States. It's and these are completely ignored. I agree completely. No signs that I didn't roll my eyes at, quite frankly.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
John, I want you to elaborate on what Daniel said about a color revolution organized type of thing by the intelligence we've seen over the decades, because this is a good point that we should probably dwell into. The fact that the Democratic Party is the one pushing this hands-off movement, and 1,200 demonstration sites over 50 U.S. states, and now they've obviously exported these to Europe and elsewhere. I want to, and it's so funny when we get into it, because the, all the Democratic pushback when Trump was in his first term, when Biden got in, and you guys very, both of you very well remember, he changed nothing. Well, not when it came to immigration, not to, I mean, to everything the Democrats, especially Biden, made lambasted Trump about and said that it's beyond inhumane, it's beyond, I mean, he used every word to demonize Trump and his policies. And guess what he did? Well, all we saw was nothing more than continuity. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, well, American foreign policy never changes. And your other guest is right. And I'm a big fan of him as well, actually. There were no signs that I didn't roll my eyes at. I mean, just idiots that Trump was a communist agent, a Putin stooge, that, you know, he was somehow bringing world communism to America. This is just, it is mind-numbingly stupid stuff, and you do wonder about it. I don't want to think my fellow Americans have sunk into this level of ignorance, but I fear they have. Is this a psyop of some sort? Yeah, I mean, it's certainly possible. There's always agent provocateurs. There's always when it's organized at this level, one does start to question things. And look, Biden was the worst president in history, and there were no protests. Biden gave his son a pardon after obvious criminal misconduct of a pretty serious kind. He's just pardoned. We had COVID under Biden. We had all kinds of foreign policy crimes under Biden. His treatment of Israel was very much the same. The foreign policy rhetoric was the same. It's the same defense contractors in office and in that revolving door at the Pentagon, CIA, State Department. It's all the same people. What Trump brings out is a certain outrage because people dislike his style. Mm. I really think that a lot of it is he's just offensive to the sensibilities of people. But also we have reached a point where the standards of living in the U.S. have deteriorated hugely. There's no work. There's no optimism about a future in which there will be work. And, you know, you have people like Elon Musk talking about universal basic income and, you know, colonies on Mars and stuff. Yeah, I get that it starts to become disturbing because it's cloud cuckoo land. And the reality, however, is when you have people supporting American imperialism and all these protests continue to, you know, defend American imperialism, the wars in Gaza, 20 years in Afghanistan, on and on and on and on, 900 military bases around the world, and now Netanyahu is going to visit to push for a war against Iran. This never changes. So why are these people out on the streets right now? Maybe it's just economic. They fear the coming depression. But it feels a little suspicious. I agree with your other guest to that degree. The level of organization is surprising, let's say.
And the contradictions we see in Donald Trump, the character, Daniel, he's pushing himself off as this anti-war guy, yet he continues to fuel Israel's genocide in Gaza. He was actually a big part of the fact that the ceasefire in Gaza broke down, and hinting, using force against Iran, against Panama, Greenland, against Mexico for all the fentanyl coming into the States. Is this self-proclaimed anti-war Donald Trump who he is, or is he just part of the, what he refers to himself as the deep state, but he doesn't realize it?
Well, I hate the term deep state because it's just the state. That's what it is. It's the state. It's the system. It's the ruling class. You know, Marx said, it's like there's an old meme of the Illuminati. And it says, "You mean ruling class, bro?" There's a picture of Marx with a glass of wine or something. I don't know. Just, I mean, the thing is that, yes, he represents the billionaire class. There's no question about that. The thing about being an anti-war person is absurd and ridiculous. You can't say that All that he ever actually said himself was that these wars were a waste of money and they were the wrong thing to do. I mean, he's very clearly looking to save money in Ukraine, to spend money to fight China on Taiwan and Iran and Yemen and so on. So it is true that what John said again about style. This is a projection. He's a con man. He's a hustler. That's who he's always been. He's trying. He's real estate, like a slumlord trying to make deals. You know, that's not that doesn't have any depth to it. And that's the whole thing, is that you can't attack Trump the person. Not that I care about the guy, but it doesn't rise to the level of mass protest. People should be voicing their actual concerns, not stylistic ones. Because I can agree with both. I know a lot of people. You run into someone in the pub who says, I like Trump. He pisses off the wrong people. I mean, the right people, sorry. He pisses off all the right people. That's what, you know, that's a style thing. They like that kind of style. Then the liberals who say he's gross and he's ew and he's this, plus he's just so offensive to everyone with a human heart. But again, style over substance has become the only metric by which Americans can value candidates and policies, and they ignore the facts, which are U.S. hegemony is going on continuously and is in real trouble. I won't doubt that the things against Trump in Europe and elsewhere are things against U.S. policy for two generations, and they should continue. And they are becoming successful in some ways, but not in the American political voting public.
Right.
At all.
And John, if I could really, quickly get your take on this whole, the tariffs regime by Donald Trump. It seems to be irking everyone from New York to London. Tariffs on everyone. Baseline of 10%, like a gratuity charge at a restaurant for practically everyone that you're trading with. Additional tariff regimes ranging from 10 to 30% from China to Mexico, from Canada, you very well know, to your American so-called, pardon, your European so-called allies there. So it's shocking. Every single market index, at least 5% were shaken over the last couple of days. A lot of economists say that a global recession is imminent. How do you see Trump's global tariff war here, John? And is it going to benefit, ultimately, the American consumer? I guess that's the big thing he's emphasizing, he's trying to do.
Ultimately, the American working class will suffer the most from this. And he doesn't care about that. The idea that somehow Trump is stumbling blindly and clumsily into a global depression is nonsense. That's what they want. Ever since COVID, there has been this kind of restructuring, global economic restructuring, a kind of contraction of capital. This will end up hurting the working class. They will be disciplined further. They will be subjected to further controls and restrictions in how they lead their lives. These marches are not about the things that they really should be about, obviously. And all the way back to Reagan, you know, destroyed unions and crushed American labor. And that's really happening again. It may make Trump unpopular for a while, but he doesn't care because, you know, this is electoral theater in a way. The people who really run the country allow this theater to take place, and everybody gets up in arms about it and clutches their pearls and make, you know, takes place in marches like this. But America should be, people should be concerned with the imperialist wars and global destruction that the U.S. and now Israel, but the targeting of China, Russia, Iran, these are crazy imperialist adventures that the U.S. is less and less capable of prosecuting. The era of U.S. power, hegemonic power, is over, and so there is an undercurrent of desperation in all of this as well from the government side.
All right, we're just about out of time. Daniel, I wanted to give you more time. We have about a little less than a minute left. Trump's also, a lot of these protests are also pushing back on Donald Trump's cabinet appointments, from Elon Musk to anti-vax Robert F. Kennedy to handle health and human services, to Tulsi Gabbard running national intelligence services, to Cash Patel heading the FBI. Good or bad for America, or to your earlier point, is he just doing this to tick people off?
He's just doing this to concentrate his power and justify the election, winning the election. Again, that's the scam, just to win the election. What he's doing is what billionaires always do. Billionaires want to make more money for themselves. That's what the trade war is about, reshaping, pulling up the drawbridges so that America can be more of an autarky to get ready for this contraction. And they're late to the game. They are scared. And that despair is visible from below, and people are latching onto it for the wrong reasons.
Great talk, gentlemen. Appreciate having you both on. Stay safe to the both of you there. Don Stepling joining us there out of Inderøy, Norway, and also Daniel Patrick Welch joining us from Boston, Massachusetts. And this brings us to end your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Seven, very much pressure.
I come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on Iran Radio with Sheikh Yasser, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Bookshelf with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. So one of the obvious events, some of us are very scared of it, some of us are terrified of it, some of us wish that it never occurs, but it will definitely occur, and it will occur to everybody, everything, in fact, is the concept of death, that everything that is not Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will be destroyed, will lose its existence, so to speak. However, what is also necessary for us to understand, that when we mean death, it does not mean that we lose existence. This is not what we mean, especially within the framework of religion and especially within the Islamic theological framework. We do not mean that death is a losing of something. Rather, death is a traversing and a means by which we travel from one place to another. That is why many of the ulama have actually written books, and certain individuals and scholars have written books based on this particular understanding of death, that death is not an end, but rather a new beginning. So they have written books and have titled it with titles such as the book that we are introducing to our dear listeners today, which is titled Life After Life, that there is a new life, a new beginning that will start after death, that death is not the end. There is another life, another realm, another place that is waiting for us. But what is important is that that particular life is structured and created by our actions, our intentions, basically every single thing that we do in this life. So inshallah, to get better acquainted with this book, please stay with us and join us in our next segment, inshallah.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage
particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. So the book that we have introduced to our dear listeners, or the title that we have mentioned rather to our dear listeners, is Life After Life. This book was written by Muhammad Jawad Nawruzi and Amir Rastin. So it was translated or commissioned by the management of foreign pilgrims of the Aslan Quds Razavi Islamic Relations Office. That is the organization that looks after takes care of the Haram and the Mausoleum of Imam Ridha alayhi salam, the 8th Holy Imam. This book was published in 2020. It was published for the first time in Mashhad. And obviously the publisher is Zaira Radhawi. That is the publishing house or the publishing that looks after or is done and under the auspices of the Haram of Imam Ridha alayhi salam. And again, as we mentioned, the title of this book is Life After Life, with the Farsi title Zindagi Pas Az Zindagi. So this book, as we mentioned, looks at death and certain things that will happen, i.e. there are certain teachings within the realm of the Islamic texts, the Islamic scriptures, the Ahadith, the Quran al-Majid, that indicate certain events that will occur in the hereafter. For example, we have what is known as the interim house. Right, this is a place where, you know, we are here, this particular zindagi or this particular life of us in this material world. And then we have what is known as barzakh, or what the author has translated as the waiting house, where we stay and we wait for the day of judgment to appear. Again, this on a very basic theological level, and for us to be judged in that particular realm, on that particular plane of existence. And therefore the last one is the eternal house, which is the day of judgment. And also in that day of judgment is where we are placed. We are either placed because of our deeds in eternal bliss, which is represented by paradise, or in eternal damnation and wretchedness, which is represented by hell and the fire, which is a means of cleansing some people. And again, there are obviously certain discussions that can be had here. So, for example, when the chapter of the waiting house, some of the questions that may be asked is, what is the purpose of the grave? What happens in the grave? What is Yawm al-Qiyamah? And so on and so forth. So these are some of the questions that this book aims to answer. So inshallah, in our next segment, we'll be reading a portion of this book for the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past, but where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves? Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. So the book that we have introduced to our dear listeners is titled Life After Life. It was written by Muhammad Jawad Nawruzi and published by the publishing house of Aslan Quds Razavi, the International Relations or the Islamic Relations Office in Mashhad. Again, the Shrine of Imam Ridha alayhi salam. So the portion that we would like to read for our dear listeners is titled What Happens in the Grave. So birth, death, and resurrection are the three stages which have been considered as the critical stages of human life, because the transition from one life stage to the succeeding one is very complicated and difficult, or the proceeding one. Death is a journey into the unknown, but like any journey, it goes better if you are prepared. Now we intend to discover the mysteries of the seemingly calm cemeteries to know what happens to the dead. Of course, we are also going to elaborate on the comforting factors in the grave. A. The secret of the burial night. The burial night would seem to be the first night after the burial of the body in the grave. But truly it starts from the very moments of death, as it has little relation with the physical body. The first night in the grave is a relaxing night for believers and a horrible night for disbelievers and wrongdoers. This very important night for the deceased has various stages, such as the question of the grave. The grave in the Islamic notion refers to the world of barzakh, which is a place between the physical world and the non-physical one. Whenever the soul of a human being enters this world, two angels, Bashir and Mubashir, in confronting with the believers, and Nakir and Munkir, in confronting with disbelievers, will appear and ask certain questions. Like, who is your God? What is your religion? Who is your prophet? Who is your imam? Inshallah, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala enable us to answer these questions correctly, properly, and rightfully, inshallah, in our graves, with the blessings of the Nabi sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Inshallah, until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Bookshelf on Iran Radio with Sheikh Yasser, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Shine on my home. in the limelight.
Iqbal Mohammed, an MP in the House of Commons, has charged the British government of directly and indirectly supporting Israel's war crimes in the Gaza Strip. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered the story and tells us more. A war crimes complaint against 10 Britons who served with the Israeli military in Gaza was submitted to the Metropolitan Police by one of the United Kingdom's leading human rights lawyers. Michael Mansfield KC is one of a group of lawyers who on Monday, 7th of April, handed in a 240-page dossier to Scotland Yard's War Crimes Unit, charging targeted killing of civilians and aid workers, including by sniper fire, and indiscriminate attacks on civilian areas, including hospitals. The report, which has been prepared by a team of British lawyers and researchers in The Hague, also charges suspects of coordinated attacks on protected sites, including historic monuments and religious sites, and forced transfer and displacement of civilians. For legal reasons, neither the names of suspects, who include officer-level individuals, nor the full report are being made public. The Israeli regime has persistently denied that its political leaders or military leaders have committed war crimes in Gaza, in which it has massacred more than 50,000 people, many of them innocent civilians. One of Britain's leading human rights lawyers, Michael Mansfield KC, who is known for his work on landmark cases such as the Grenfell Tower fire, Stephen Lawrence inquiry and the Birmingham Six, said, "If one of our nationals is committing an offence, we ought to be doing something about it. Even if we can't stop the government of foreign countries behaving badly, we can at least stop our nationals from behaving badly." Michael Mansfield added, "British nationals are under a legal obligation not to collude with crimes committed in Palestine. No one is above the law." The report, which has been submitted on behalf of the Gaza-based Palestinian Centre for Human Rights and the British-based Public Interest Law Centre, covers offences committed in the territory from October of 2023 through to May of 2024. The report took 6 months to complete. According to the report, each of the crimes attributed to the 10 individuals and suspects, some of whom are dual nationals, amounts to a war crime or a crime against humanity. We continue with The Guardian's coverage of this story. According to one eyewitness who was at a medical facility and who saw corpses scattered on the ground, especially in the middle of the hospital courtyard where many dead bodies were buried in a mass grave. The eyewitness said a bulldozer ran over a dead body in a horrific and heart-wrenching scene, desecrating the dead. They also said a bulldozer demolished part of the hospital. Sean Summerfield, a barrister at Doughty Street Chambers, who helped compile the dossier, said it was based on an open source evidence and witness testimony, which together presented a compelling case. Sean Summerfield said, "The public will be shocked, I would have thought, to hear that there's credible evidence that British nationals have been directly involved in committing some of those atrocities in the Gaza Strip, adding that the team wanted to see individuals appearing at the Old Bailey to answer for atrocity crimes. The report says Britain has a responsibility under international treaties to investigate and prosecute those who have committed core international crimes. Section 51 of the International Criminal Court Act 2001 states that it is an offence against the law of England and Wales for a person to commit genocide, a crime against humanity, or a war crime, even if it takes place in another country. Raji Surani, the director of the Public Interest Law Centre, said, "This is illegal, this is inhuman, and enough is enough. The British government cannot say we didn't know. We are providing them with all the evidence." Paul Heron, the legal director of the Public Interest Law Centre, said, "We're filing our report to make clear these war crimes are not in our name." Scores of legal human rights experts have signed a letter of support urging the war crimes team to investigate the complaints. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Iqbal Mohammed, a member of parliament in Britain's House of Commons, recently has charged the British government of direct and indirect support of Israel's war crimes in Gaza. Iqbal Mohammed said, "I'm afraid that the British government, when these war criminals are brought to justice, will also be indicted for being complicit in these war crimes." Iqbal Mohammed, part of the Independent Alliance group of five MPs supporting Gaza, including former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn, spoke to Anadolu news agency about his opposition to the British government's support for the Israeli regime. He condemned Israel's massacring of innocent civilians in Gaza and the occupied West Bank, calling for an end to such actions and urging those complicit to withdraw their support from the Israeli regime. Iqbal Mohammed said, "It's very simple. We need to stop the massacre of innocent civilians in Gaza, north, south, across the region and in the occupied West Bank. How much more killing should there be before the British government will stop in its direct and indirect support of Israel committing these war crimes? They don't want to call it a genocide. It is a genocide. They don't want to call it ethnic cleansing, but it is ethnic cleansing. They don't want to call it mass murder, but it is mass murder." Iqbal Mohammed emphasised that ending the massacres against Palestinians is a priority, noting that he and a number of other MPs raised the issue at every opportunity in the House of Commons. He said, "We want the government to stop with the talking and start acting." 30 arms licenses banned out of a total of 350 is simply not enough. The parts that go to supply the repair of the F-35s must stop. They are the biggest, most common killing machine. The website of Arab News has also covered the same story and tells us more. A former British Supreme Court judge has described Israel's assault on Gaza as grossly disproportionate and said there was at least an arguable case that it was genocidal. Lord Sumption, who served on Britain's highest court from 2012 to 2018, was one of the highest profile signatories of a letter last year warning that the British government was breaching international law by arming the Israeli regime. In September, the Labour government suspended some arms export licences to Israel but made an exception for parts for F-35 fighter jets, a contentious decision that is being challenged in the courts of law. Lord Sumption was speaking to the British media before the release of his new book, The Challenges of Democracy and the Rule of Law, which does not address the situation in Gaza, but warns of threats to free speech, which the former judge said included expressions of pro-Palestinian sentiments. Explaining his decision to sign the letter, Lord Sumption said, "I thought and I still think that the conduct of Israel in Gaza is grossly disproportionate, and there is at least an arguable case that is genocide. One can't put it higher than that, because genocide depends on intent. That's quite a different thing to establish, but I read the provisional decision of the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, and it seemed to me that they were saying that that was an arguable proposition." Lord Sumption added, "Given that the obligation of parties to the Genocide Convention is proactively to prevent it happening and not just to react after the event, I thought that the authors of the letter, and I wasn't the draftsman, had got a point."